past again, so we can start. And like during every lecture, just log in and find at least three friends. And if there's trouble logging in or the web polls, has everyone been able to get the web polls or the lecture questions during the lecture to work properly? Anyone have persistent troubles with these? Okay, great. So we won't have much troubles today. Okay, today, well, I was asked to provide English slides, and well, this avoids me having to read Finnish and speak English at the same time, which makes it slightly easier for me and a lot easier for those, I guess, five people who are, you know, doing this course in English. And hopefully it's causing minimal trouble for you, rest of you. And okay, what we are going to do today, we are going to discuss a bit more about types, few more of these finding the boundaries of type system type questions. Then we are talking about, well, we don't talk about lists and list comprehensions really. Only things that I'm going to say about those I'm going to say in a few minutes. And then we are going to talk about recursion. You know, recursion as a replacement for a loop in other languages, and recursion as a general problem solving tool, as a thinking tool versus a you know, programming tool. And about the list and list comprehensions, these are very nice things in Haskell, but they are not essential. So you can find the material and go to this lists and list comprehensions section, and you will find that I have linked to a, you know, freely available Haskell book for you to read. So go and read those things there. And if you have trouble with them, you know, you can ask me or someone else, but pretty much you won't need to use them during the course, but they're very useful if you care to learn them. Yeah, that's it about those. I'm not going to discuss those today. If you need that information, you can come and ask. So, any other comments about my agenda? No? Okay, let's proceed. How many of you have tried the type-driven programming exercise? Yeah, almost all. Great. How many of you found it very difficult? There are either, you know, very good students or bit shy students. But it's common to find that exercise quite difficult. So I thought I add few more of these lecture questions about types, just to check if we need to, you know, reiterate this thing again. So the whole point about type variables is that if you find a definition in Haskell that uses a type variable, and you want to use that definition, you get to decide what the type variable is. So if you have some function with as many type variables as possible, you can use it in, you know, many places of your program. Whereas if you have concrete types, just like function int to int, you can only use that when you have an integer or int. If you have a to b or something like this, then you can fit any type you like there. So they're more generic. However, if you write a definition that has a type variable, you are more constrained. So if you try to write a function from a to a, it has to work for any selection of a, including any type that I'm going to define in the future. So any type I'm going to invent in the next 3 years, it has to work with that. So it's obvious that you have very little to work with if you are writing this kind of a function. Function from a to a, it's either something that's, you know, looping forever or throwing an exception, or it's the identity function. There's nothing else. Those are your only options. So to give an example, if you have x of type a, where a is a type variable, any of these, you know, examples should work. You know, I can choose what the x is, so I can call it as a function, I can add a number there. It should be pretty obvious that you can't give a proper definition for such an x. What kind of an x is a function and a number and a list at the same time? Yeah, won't exist. And what do I mean by proper definition? Of course, you can make, you know, in multiple ways. you have, let's say, if I want something of type A, I can, you know, raise an exception. This is a valid expression of type A. It can be anything. You can write this literally any place of your program where it's syntactically correct. Also, if I define something like this, yeah, that's whatever type you want. So Haskell is not, you know, it's not logic. We can make these absurd types. But whenever we are, you know, using these, you know, if I evaluate x, if I evaluate that expression, what do I get? You know, nothing. It's just going around and x is an x is an x is an x. And it's not going to return anything. It might, the compiler might actually be smart enough that, yeah, we are looping. We are not going to go anywhere else. So it converts the infinite loop to an exception and breaks our program. So this is actually a very useful thing to have, because if you have polymorphic functions with lots of type variables, there are very few ways to actually implement these functions, and especially very few ways to implement them wrong. So if you have something like function composition, or curry functions, there's only one working implementation for each of these. Can't make them wrong. So if it type checks, it's going to work, or it's going to be one of those infinite recursions or exceptions or whatever. And you know, this makes it very easy to write abstract stuff, because it can't go wrong. It literally can't go wrong. And when you add, you know, if you put, say, double, 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 then the function can return pretty much any double you want. There's no guarantee of it working correctly. But with type variables, it will work correctly. So, based on the previous ranting, let's try this kind of an exercise. This means that, you know, for which of these types can I have a sensible definition? Sensible meaning that it's not going to loop forever or throw an exception or do anything like this. And first we, you know, think this by ourselves. And someone asked why we have this individual thought part. It turns out that if we don't think this for us, privately first, the discussions are going to be rather bad. It doesn't lead to so much of improvement. Also, I have added this small counter there. This counts how many people have answered the question, so I kind of can approximate when enough people have answered, so we don't waste that much time. This was suggested to me by someone in this audience, I guess. But okay, figure this out by yourself. Let's set the limit to, can we get 30 answers? I think we have at least that many people here. Okay, you can't get the questions. Did you log in? No, siinä tapauksessa jos ei toimi, niin hankkiudu jonkun viereen, joka saa ne toimimaan. Ja katsotaan sitten, miten se suoritusraksi menee. So, okay, if it doesn't work, try to refresh the page. Front row says that it might work. And it's not terribly critical. If you miss few questions and I mark you as, not being present in the exercise, we can always, somehow make this work. You know, I can ask the questions during the supervised sessions and it will be okay. Okay, 21 answers. 25. Yeah, 3 more and I continue talking, so be fast. Yeah, that's So, let's see. And yeah, which of these can be sensibly implemented? And seems it's quite even. Well, the second one seems especially obvious. Not entirely obvious, but you know, if I give you whatever, can you give me a Boolean? Yeah, you can always say true and false. But the rest seem to be rather, you know, evenly split. So I guess this group discussion might work. And what is the reason behind this group discussion? One of the big benefits is that I know this stuff very intimately. I know how it works. And if I tell you how it works, it's going to be vague and superficial, and it's going to use terms that you don't know. If you almost know how it works, you can explain it better to your friends than I ever can. So, you know, get cracking. Yeah, that's a list. It's a list.
Sort of, that's the idea.
Okay. First thought, we have 42 people in the classroom, I guess. Okay. So, which of these can't be or can be sensibly implemented? Okay. Did we change our opinions at all? Slightly. Okay. First one. Basically, this says, I'm a function, give me a Boolean, and I will give you whatever you want. So, A has to be, you know, if I ask for a string, it has to give me a string. If I ask a list, it's going to give me a list. If it's going to be an airline ticket booking system and I want to ask information about the plane, I get information about the plane. So, can't implement that. So, I guess from previous courses, the most common idea is that, you know, you implement this function so that you make an if statement, and if it's true, then you return a string, and if it's false, then you return an int, or something like this. Am I right? What is the idea in this bar? Just throw it out.
What? Replacing. Replacing.
Replacing what?
According to the value of that Boolean.
Yeah. Yeah. The problem here is that you don't know what the A is. You can't touch the A. You can't, you know, make it. It's impossible to generate a new A without knowing what it is. Consider, for example, this funny data type. This is, I can define an empty data type. It's called funny. I can use it in types. I can, for example, say that I will, you know, have a list of funny data types. But it has no constructors. I can't ever make a value of type funny because there's, you know, this part is empty. There's no constructor possible. So the first function is basically promising that it will anyways, even though it's impossible, produce this funny value for me. Okay, did you get the idea? It produces anything even if it's impossible to produce that said value. Okay, maybe it's confusing. Maybe we can proceed. Okay, the second one. It's not possible. It's not definitely not possible. Even if I give you a Boolean and you have to give me an arbitrary type, I don't tell you what the type is, you can't. Second one. Yes, definitely you can. If I give you, you know, whatever, you have to give me back a Boolean. I mean, well, I give you a car and you give me false. I give you an airplane, you give me false. Yes, you can implement this. It's, you know, meaning I give you whatever and you give me either true or false. So it's a constant function. It's either a constant false or constant true. Okay, this is clear. This one is 50-50 split. So basically it says, I will give you a Boolean and I want to get back a list of functions from A to A. So can I make this? Well, of course I can make this, because functions, these nice things here. Basically, the arrow says that whatever is on the left-hand side, I can assume that someone gives that thing to me, and then I have to return what is on the right-hand side. So basically, here is a function that, given an A, will return an A, which is a very easy thing to do, because I just got an A, and I have to give it back. So, for example, and, well, here we have it. So, of course, this, we are studying the boundaries of the language, so this is not perhaps so sensible function, but it's easy to do. We have the Boolean. then we can, you know, do something with the Boolean or not. We don't have to write the if. And we have to return a list. And simple, you know, identity function. Give me an x, I will return the same x. That obviously has the type from A to A. So there is this. So any time you see something like this, a function from something to something, if you can make this given this, then it's okay. Then you can always write values like this. So it's called, you know, it's a negative of something. It's this thing doesn't go inside the function when you define the function. It goes inside when you use the function, and then your definition can use it. Finally, if I have, so the answer for this is true. Of course we can make this. Finally, this says if I have a list of functions from arbitrary A to Boolean, can I get an A from here? Can I extract an A from things like this? Okay, from the green bar, can I? Explanation, why? How can I? Anyone brave enough? If anyone is brave enough to, you know, justify answer from this green bar, I will give him a Terry Pratchett book, an arbitrary Terry Pratchett book. Okay, two arbitrary Terry Pratchett books selected by me. Okay, based on your reluctance, I think you are no longer convinced that this is actually the case that this can be implemented. Yeah, I get list of functions from A to Bool. I have no A. You know, if I would have an A, I could get a Boolean out of here. Perhaps, if the list is not empty. And consider even this case that, you know, I'm giving an empty list as an argument. There's no functions inside, and I still have to give you an A. I mean, I have nothing and I have to give you an A, and I don't even know what the A is, so not possible. Even if there are some functions, you know, at best I could get a Boolean outside from the functions, but, you know, there's no A inside, so I can't. Okay, are we still very confused? This is the one of the difficult parts. How many of you have taken a formal logic course, like a logic in mathematics or philosophy? You know, you should. It's fun. There's this most difficult thing in philosophical logic is the material implication. It's, you know, they use the same symbol as a function. It's the same thing as a function, and all the philosophy students have huge difficulties with it. So this is the same thing. It's a bit like, you know, powers in, you know, math, and it's like one difficult thing. So might require some, you know, thinking to get it correctly inside your brain. Okay. I just, you know, said this in so many words, so skip. Okay, then, you know, do it yourself. If I have an x that happens to have this type, a function from A to B, how can I extract an A from that function? And this is one of those questions that I think most of you will, you know, kind of know the answer already, since I said it something like three times. But the problem is not getting the answer correct, it's getting your brains aligned so that you can accept that the answer is correct. And if need to be, you know, this is a topic that I can spend, you know, whole 2 hours on if necessary. It's, you know, rather important. Okay, let's cut it again at the 30 answers. So, yeah, 30 answers, thank you. So, let's see. Yeah, there are, I think, at least 3 people I have to reconvince. Because the correct answer is, of course, yeah, just forget about this. There is no A inside A arrow B. Pretty much like this. You know Blender. It's a device that you use to make smoothies, for example. You know, Blender is thing that converts fruit into smoothies. If I give you a blender, can you give me fruit? No, there's no fruit inside the blender unless it's already loaded. So, and even then you get a smoothie, not the fruit. Right, okay. You know, if this feels vague, spend the entire next 2 days thinking about this. You know, it's not kidding. So, okay, onwards. This thing changes a little bit if we add type class constraints. These were the things before the fat arrow in the types. For example, show is a function that converts any A into a string if the A has, you know, specific functions defined for it. Similarly, this A, you know, if it's some kind of fractional number and some kind of integral, we get an A. So A without any constraints, it's absolutely any type in the world. However, if we add constraint like show or, you know, integral, then it can't be anything. It can be only those things that have this, you know, interface defined for them. So basically, this means that this A, I can implement a value of this type. It's very easy. I can do it like, is this high enough? Yeah, it's high enough. Mm-hmm. Boom, boom. Oh, let's use just the integral to make explanation easier. Yep. Easy to make. How can I make this A? And what is the mechanism that allows me to do this? Well, integral, that's a type class. It basically, you know, gives me all of these functions to call if I use it. Also, it makes, you know, says that it, or if something is an integral, it also has to be an enum and a real. Never mind what these things are. We can just check. Real, yeah, it's something like this. If we have real, we can use durational, okay? More importantly, if something is a real number or approximation of real numbers, it's also a number. Let's trace that back. A number, it's a thing that you can add, subtract, negate, whatever. This is slightly broken in Haskell. It's not as nice as it could be. But most importantly, it has this from integer function. So if something is a number, I can convert an integer to that value. And that is the way I can make or define values like this. So I wrote x equals to 1. Numbers are overloaded in Haskell. So if you have an ordinary number there, the compiler interprets number literals as, you know, statements from integral that number. So, yeah, now it's obvious why I can do this. I have a function that takes an integer and returns an A if the A is of type class num. So I can create an arbitrary A with these few constraints which make it not so arbitrary after all. So, idea behind constraints. So try to think how this changes the answer before. And I selected, you know, numbers and, you know, equality. Ik means that you can compare them. If you haven't seen EQ before, it's the thing, you know, almost all Haskell types except functions are in this class. EQ means that you can check if the values are equal or you can check if the values are not equal. That's the only thing EQ does. So which of these are now possible given the constraint? This is essentially a harder question than the one before this. You have to know things to answer this one. And I guess this is enough information for you to make the decision. There will be so many slides that I won't have time for today. Okay, 17 answers. Let's see if we can get 30 answers and we can go forward. Yep, a few more. Yeah, missing still one. Yeah, enough. So, let's see. Okay. So it looks like this. Pretty much, you know, 50-50 on each account. Okay, let's see if, you know, a short group discussion improves this answer.
Also,
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Okay, all but one of you have answered, I guess. Yeah, so which of these can you implement properly? Again, the offer for one Terry Pratchett book stands. Anyone from this, why would you know, why wouldn't you be able to implement that? Anyone? Well, of course you can implement that. Essentially, we have that, you know, wrong function. We essentially have this function already. So, you know, from integer, given a integer which is nice and concrete type, it makes me an any number. You know, if I give it 5, I can get Boolean, not Boolean, but double or float or whatever number type, a complex number, anything goes. And, it's trivial to think about how you would convert Boolean into an integer. 0 if false, 1 if true, or any other combination. So you have a path. You first convert a Boolean to an integer, then you use the from integer function I just demonstrated to give you the A. So there is a path. Okay, next. I give you a Boolean, and you give me back something. I don't tell you what it is, but I can tell you that I can compare them. So what does this EQ give me? It gives me very little. It gives me these two functions. Comparison for equality, comparison for, inequality. Both of these functions basically consume these A's and return Booleans. So I can't get an A out of either of these things. This EQ class, it doesn't imply existence of any other class. So all I have to work with are these two functions. To use these functions, I would need the A's. But here, the proposition is that I get a bool. You give me a bool, I give you an A. Can't make it. And, this is kind of the point that some type class constraints might allow you to build up these values, and some don't. But it's all, encoded in the class definition. If there is such a method that builds the value there, then of course you can use it. But if there isn't, then yeah, you can't. It depends. Finally, any arguments from this group here? I really wonder how high I have to go. I don't know what is the current going rate for Terry Pratchett books. If you give me justification for this part. Doesn't have to be correct.
The Norse chaos gods demand it. The chaos gods of the ancient Norse mythologies demand it. Does that come?
I wasn't specific enough. Yeah, come and clean your books after the lecture. Okay, why can I make this? Because, I don't need to make an A. A is given to me, and then I throw it away because I don't actually need it for anything. And I need to return a B. And, how do I get that B? there's my B. So the function would be let F of I don't care be 0. And there's my function. I can even be better. I don't need to constrain this to be a Boolean because only thing I do is I throw it away. So, please think about this when you are walking home or have trouble sleeping or anything like this. No, spend 15 minutes. It's quite an easy thing, but you have to think it from correct perspective for it to make sense. And for next lecture, I have to come up with a definition of a sensible answer also. Okay, to the meat of the lecture. That was just, you know, in case you had trouble with the types. Now about the recursion. And I'm so going to run out of time during this lecture, so probably the next lecture will also be slightly about recursion. So, what is recursion? That's the big thing for this week and the next week. Recursion is a very simple thing. It's something that we use in Haskell all the time. Nevertheless, how many of you have heard about this nerd news site called Slashdot? Yeah, surprisingly few people. It used to be very popular. 5 years back, everyone would have, you know, waved their hand. It had this article where someone is asking that, you know, these old and forgotten techniques like, you know, eval or goto or recursion, perhaps these could be useful. You know, recursion is, you know, if you are Java coder or C-sharp coder, it's really something that you never use, basically. If you use it, then you eventually convert it to a loop, and that's it. So if you go to programming 2 course, for example, the definition of recursion, it's really, you know, confusing. You have to think about stacks and variables and scope and all these things. Whereas in, you know, Haskell, it's very simple. We don't have to think about any stacks or stack frames or things like this. Recursion is just a definition that refers to itself. For example, I can have values that are defined recursively. Ones is a list that has one in front of the list and then list called ones after it. So it's 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, to, you know, as far as you can count it. I can define Fibonacci numbers with this strange, really funny way. You can try this. This is actually surprisingly efficient way to define list of Fibonacci numbers. So what is common with these definitions? They refer once or twice or multiple times to themselves. And how do you compute a definition like this? So we have practiced computing by hand. So if we have and we compute ones. Well, obviously, because of the definition, it's we just replace this symbol with the definition. Okay, we do it again. There's no mystery at all here. Just keep replacing this symbol with its definition. It doesn't matter if the, you know, it's self-referring. There's actually no mystery here at all. So values can be recursive. Data types can be recursive. We have already seen one data type that is clearly recursive. A list. It's either an empty list or, you know, one element in front of another list. It's a recursive. It's probably the simplest recursive structure that I can think of. How many of you have taken the Algorithms 1 course? Yeah, great, I can talk about binary trees. Binary tree, it's, you know, either empty tree or, you know, some value and two branches, which are also binary trees. So it's a one-line definition in Haskell to define a binary tree, which is very nice. And it's also recursive. Functions, we have seen, you know, few functions that are recursive. Simple summing function. Sum of an empty list is zero. Sum of a non-empty list is, you know, first element plus sum of the rest of the elements. Very simple stuff. And, you know, with the recursion, I have always this trouble of, you know, what am I going to, you know, say about this? Anything more? It's, you know, you refer to your own definition. That's a recursion. That's it. That's all there is. I actually went through a few Haskell books before this lecture. and, you know, take a Java book. If it has a chapter about recursion, it's going to be, you know, 20 pages, 30 pages long. It's going to have all these details. And you take a Haskell book with a recursion, it's just going to be about one page. Yeah, it's a definition that refers to itself. So it's you know, not so nice topic for a lecture. Also, recursion is easy in Haskell. It's not difficult at all when you... what happened? When you get to it. So first thing, of course, is that, you know, most of you have programmed in some other language. And, you know, chances are that the other language had loops. You used loops for everything. Everything was a loop. So in Haskell, we have no loops because we don't have the changing I in the for loop. So we have to use a recursion. And, you know, if you are really old school programmers with lots of experience in other languages, you are thinking that, yeah, recursion is, it's going to be slow. It's going to blow my stack eventually. It's faster to make a loop. And then you are thinking that Haskell is probably a very slow language because everything is a recursion. Well, Haskell might be slower than C, but not that much. Recursion is more general. You can express more computations with a recursion than you can with a for loop. I think Antti-Juhani will again correct me if I'm wrong. I always defer these computational things to... Yeah. No, yeah, well, okay, if you emulate recursion with loop, okay, I was slightly wrong with this. Okay, the thing is that, you know, loops themselves, forgetting if you put a stack inside by yourself, loops pretty much always compile to efficient code. They always compile to same, you know, machine code. Recursion, however, since you can write it in many different ways, for example, this, you know, this thing here, you have two occurrences of the, you know, definition there. So it's probably not going to compile to as efficient code. However, the story is that, you know, if you write recursion, you know, in same form as you would write a loop, it will be just as efficient. So there's no trade-off in speed and expressivity here. And how do you do this? Okay, we have two big, you know, things that will bite you if you use a recursion wrong in the early course. There are many to come in the future. So here we have this, you know, simple sum function. And the question is, how do you actually, if you are a Haskell compiler, let's assume that you are non-optimizing Haskell compiler that exists today and not some imaginary supercompiler that you might be able to write. What's going to happen? Plain Haskell, how is it going to compute like this? Or is it going to compute like this? Is it good or bad? Yes? Oh, yeah. Of course, some XS, not plain XS. Otherwise, this would have been a really a trick question. Thank you. I promised you at least one typo per lecture. Here it is, the one quarter typo. So, which one is it? And we again wait for 30 answers by yourself. And also consider whether it's a good thing or bad thing. Is it nice to evaluate like this? Is it nice to evaluate like this, or is it bad to evaluate like this? Bad to evaluate like this. Make a value judgment. It's a pretty funny question, but, you know, play with me. Okay, enough answers. Okay, what's your opinion? Okay, so you know, most of you think it's going to be B, it seems. And you know, most of you think that it's, you know, going to be nice that it goes like this. So for your group discussion, which I insist that you have, consider this. Since Haskell is, you know, in a sense, if you take a really bird's eye view, that is something that is, you know, inside the memory of the computer when you are executing this program. In a form or another, it's a really bird's eye view. So this thing here. Consider case where this list is 1 million elements long. Then consider what has to be stored in the memory of the computer. Okay, answers in groups. Yeah. Okay. And if someone was late, I can just update it. Oh, I guess no one was. Yeah. So now most of you changed sides. basically because I hinted. You know, B, which is good, everyone agrees that it's going to be the B. And obviously it's going to be the B because, you know, this, you know, sum XS, I'm missing the sum still here, it's one unit. It's going to go inside these parentheses. You can't split it apart. But, you know, now most of you think it's bad. It's not nice that it does this. And why is it not nice? Consider, if we have this simple graph, and again, I'm simplifying enormously, because the compiler does all kinds of things that, you know, would affect this. But in principle, this is the number of steps taken or time used to compute this expression. Now, the first expression or first way to compute this is where you actually compute the sum. You compute this 1 plus 2, you reduce that first. This would have a memory versus time profile like this. It's going to start from somewhere. This is the amount of memory you need to store the original list in. Yeah, it's going to go like this. Each step you need less and less memory, which is an excellent thing, because then you can use the remaining memory for some other things. Now, the second one, which is what actually happens, is that, yeah, the list is reducing. You know, the garbage collection is going to eat the numbers from the list, but they are stored in this big pending computation called TUNC. And, you know, numbers, you know, go away from the list, but get added to this TUNC. So it's going to go like this. It's going to be using a constant amount of memory. And that's not really nice. You know, we have, it's going to use too much memory in this part. And the worst thing about this is that if we have a reference to this list, we need to use it for some other purpose. Something like making this simple calculation of averages, average the list, the numbers in the list. Now, when we are computing like this, this TUNC or this pending computation expands and expands and it becomes big. And this list that it's processing becomes smaller and smaller. Except that if we use this list XS in the definition of length, the garbage collection or the Haskell runtime can throw away the numbers that it has computed with already. Meaning that what happens to this graph with this, you know, computation, the one on the left, it looks like not good. If you sum really many numbers with this naive algorithm, you are going to just use up all the memory in the computer. It's going to crash. And that's, I guess, what people are, you know, this. That's a sensible opposition to Haskell as a language. It's very easy to actually eat up all the memory in the computer. And that is bad.
100
millions will crash. Yeah, it takes time. Of course, the definition of the sum, it's not that nice definition that I gave you there. It's defined in a much more efficient way. It's obviously possible to write it so that it does the other thing. Most of the Haskell constructs that you find in the standard library, they are, you know, taking this into account. And there are a few small tricks that you can use to avoid this phenomenon. And I'm going to show you one of these tricks about now. This is called a space leak, and people really fear space leaks because there's, you know, in Java or things like language like this, you have time leaks. Your program takes too long time and you optimize. In Haskell, it takes too much space and you have to optimize. But you are unfamiliar about how to optimize for space. So here is the alternative. This is called an accumulator variable. So we make alteration to this sum function. We make different version. It has this one extra argument here. And when the list is empty, it's going to return the extra argument. And if the list is not empty, it's going to, you know, add x to this extra argument and then call sum with those as the result. So how does this work? Since we are, you know, having this part here, it's one, you know, it's inside single parentheses, it has nothing recursive inside, we end up with computation like this. So the first one, we call it like sum zero my list. First one gets added to the zero. The order of the variables might be in another way, but basically we get this calculation here. And there's no recursive calls, nothing that has to be evaluated anymore, so we can evaluate this. Similar next step, we take the two. Yeah, this one is two, that one is the one, and we get this one plus two. Again, this is something that we can evaluate. And this reduces the consumption of memory to a minimum. Except you probably see one, you know, strange symbol in the board. Haskell is a lazy language. So it's going to go, and why would I compute 1 plus 0? I can do that later. And it's going to build up the huge thunk in this accumulator variable, which is again, you know, horrible. Luckily, the compiler is pretty smart. It often is can optimize these things away. What we can use is this, you know, bang pattern there. It says that, you know, if I get a value here, if I'm called with some value, this thing has to be evaluated at least a little bit first. Little bit means that if it's an, you know, number, it's going to be evaluated, you know, full way. If it's going to be a list, it's going to check if it's an empty list or if it's a list with some elements. This means that whenever we are calling this sum, this part has to be computed through. So that's the bang here. We are going to talk about this thing a lot more when we are visiting folds, or probably Antihon is going to do that. So use accumulator parameters. That's how you get something that is identical to a loop, basically. There's nothing hanging around this sum. It's just calling sum over and over again, reducing the value in between. This is the trick you want to use. Okay, clear. Scary, slightly. It's very easy trick when you try it. Okay, second problem with the recursion. This, you can start answering already while I talk. This is not something that, you know, actually happens when you are building large Haskell programs, mainly because you don't use lists as a data structure in large Haskell programs. You use something that is more memory efficient anyways. So you don't usually get this problem. But for this course, you have something that you have to be alert about. So plus plus, it's going to jam two lists together. Does it matter in which order I do this? I'm assuming that everyone tried the easy recursion exercise where you had to define the concatenation of lists. Just to check, did you try to write the plus plus by yourself? It was one of the exercises for this week. Yeah, some of you did. Okay, 6 more people and we can continue. I have one super important topic for, you know, after this, so I think we should race a bit. Yeah, enough. So, yeah, which is faster? You know, I think the answers are, you know, evenly split. Do you think that if you would discuss with your friends, you are going to swing one way or the other? Oh, okay. So since we are short on time, I will actually tell you the answer. You know, always prefer this one. Where do you get things like this in the first place? Why would you write either of those? Of course, you don't write any of these. You will write recursive functions. At some point, you find that it would be nice to add something at the end of my list here. And you add it to the end using the plus plus operator, and then you make a recursive call, which produces something like this. And there is a clear difference. There's an absolutely clear difference if you have many, many, many lists. These are, you know, even asymptotically different, meaning that some, at, you know, enough lists and the other one is going to be infinitely worse than the other. And why is this? The definition of this plus plus operator, if you didn't do the exercise yet, here's the answer. Makes your life slightly easier. If I add empty list in front of list ys, I'm going to get ys. And the rest of the definition is basically this. It's going to go through the first list, one by one moving the elements from the first list to the head of the elements in the resulting list. So, yes, I have the recursive call there. Nice. So, what it means that it's going to, you know, do something for all of the elements in this leftmost argument. So it's going to go through all the elements and move them in front of the resulting list. And, you know, basically it's never going to touch the YS. It's just going to, you know, put all the elements in front of the YS, and that's the resulting list. Now, if you have this thing here, this is a, probably a short list and a short list. This is a bit longer list. Now, this operator has to go over this quite long list already, produces even longer list. And this operator has to go through this whole big list again. So it takes really many steps. It's going to go over this list, you know, once, twice, three times. So if this is million elements long, it's going to do 3 million useless computations. Not nice. Whereas here, you know, this list, suppose there's something to compute here. We compute once. Then we never, you know, touch the elements of that list ever again. Then we compute something here. We go through all the elements in the YS and add them in front of that big list. Go through these once and never touch them again. Same here. XS, we go through it once and never touch it again. Just put the remaining part on the end. So, like I said, this is not an industrial Haskell programmer's problem. It's a problem for when you first encounter Haskell and you work with lists. So, if you have, you know, in your code something that looks like something like this, then you're going to hit this problem, and your function is only able to work with small lists or small number of lists. If you make a recursive call, you pass in a list, and you add something at the end of that list. That's going to be slow. So figure out how to make that one. The main idea, use the accumulator parameter, because that's going to automatically produce you the first form in most cases. Okay. Done, I guess. Any questions? Is this clear? Okay, these were, the, I guess, the hard parts of the recursion or the technical parts. And final thing that is in the agenda today, which I find important, is the way how you think about recursive problems. Because, you know, this is one of those things that there's wrong way to think about this and a better way to think about this. And the wrong way seems obvious, and the better way is not so obvious. So we have this one strategy called divide and conquer. It's a problem-solving strategy. You don't have to be programming to use this. And you get familiar with this in the algorithms course and whatever. It goes like this. You have a big problem, and then you figure out if the problem was, you know, somehow reduced. You are, say, summing a list. You know, if you are summing an empty list, it's going to be zero. If you are summing a list of one element, the answer is obvious. You first find out all the obvious cases that you can solve. Small enough input, and there is always something that you can use to, you know, directly tell the answer for. Then, after figuring out what are the absolute atoms of your program, the smallest things that you can easily solve, you take a, you know, bigger problem, find a way to split this bigger problem into pieces. Suppose we are making a sum of a list, and our language is, we are not caring about the efficiency. We could split the list in two halves. That's how you make two smaller problems. If you, I tell you to sum all the numbers in a phone book, rip the phone book in two parts and give one here and one here. And then those guys will give you the sums, and you can just sum the big number. So next step is to assume that the smaller problems are solved. You don't have to really care how these are solved. They are just automatically solved. You are summing all the phone book numbers together, rip the phone book in half, give one here. You don't care how these guys are going to make this insane computation, but you can just trust that, you know, diligent students, they will, you know, give me the correct number. Just make this assumption. It will happen. And then you have to figure out that you get the answer, you know, 1 million and 1 billion here, and then add them together. That's easy. It's usually very easy. And you're done. So what you are missing, you don't have to think about how the computation proceeds. These are all the things that you have to think about. Okay, let's make an example. Binary trees are the canonical example of all divide and conquer things. They are the simplest possible thing that we can divide and conquer. So here is a recursive data type, a binary tree. Binary tree has a value at the root. The A is here, it's now number 12. Then it has a left subtree and the right subtree. So that's, you know, that hooked me to Haskell first time I saw it. Defining binary tree in C, I was taught to program in C was like, you know, a huge problem. You had to make all kinds of pointer manipulations. In Haskell, it's just one line or two lines if your font is big. So we have a task. A binary tree. We don't care if it's a binary search tree, it's just a data structure like this. Defined using, you know, this construct here. And we want to enumerate all the elements in the binary tree by level. So we want the 12, 10, 17, 13, 2, 9, 19, 8, 11, 14. We want to make this list of levels. And at least for me, if I look at this, and I'm not thinking using the divide and conquer strategy, this is insanely hard. Might be that I'm not the smartest fellow here, but for me it's insanely hard. And, you know, how do I, you know, go here and store 7 somewhere and go and back and then pick up the 7 from, can't be done with my simple mind. So how do you do this? How do you solve this? There's two ways that I know. You go to the algorithms course and you get the algorithm, you know, it's going to read in the book. Just use the algorithm in the book. Or you use divide and conquer, which basically means I don't think, and I may not think, about the subproblems. This is forbidden. You can't do this. If you find yourself thinking what happens here, slap yourself. You're going wrong. Instead, you think like this. Okay, I have the 12 that was on top of my tree, and I have the levels for this part of the tree and answer for that part of the tree. Those are the things that I'm now interested in. And surprise, surprise, if we look at it like this, we have, let's suppose we are building a big let statement, we get variable root. It's going to be 12. Then we get levels of the left subtree. It's going to be 7, 2, 9, 8, 11. Where do we get them? Well, I don't care. I just forbade you to think about this. We assume that we get this. Then we get, you know, levels on the right. 13, 19, 14. Again, we don't care how we got those. They just automatically appear. And we want this list here. And you know, if we have that, that, and we want that, it's not really hard anymore. It's, you know, we put the 12, we put it in the front of the list. Then we take these 7 and 13 and, you know, concatenate those. We take the 2 and 9 and 19, concatenate those. And 8 and 11 and 14, those two lists, and concatenate those. Then we have the answer. It's so very simple. Only thing that can go wrong is, you know, you make a typo there. It's very easy to think. And that's how it actually is implemented. You don't ever have to figure out how to make these. Only thing that is left here is you have to figure out what you get in the base case. What is the base case? What is the binary tree that which has the obvious answer? The empty binary tree. If we have an empty binary tree, the result will be an empty list. And these are the only bits and pieces that you actually need to complete this problem. Okay, this is an interesting challenge. Can I actually program this in, what, 11 minutes? Or probably 10 when I get started. Okay, I'll try to program this for you in 10 minutes and show you it's very simple. Anyone opposed to this? Grinding through code in Haskell. Oh, it's going to be 10 minutes already. So, yeah. And Tmux. I never. So here is my binary tree. It's either empty or a thing with a root and two branches. And probably can be automatically compared to equality. Then and it's going to take, you know, more than the 10 minutes for the example alone. So under 7 we have branch 2, which has nothing inside, and branch 9, which has branch, and if you spot me doing mistakes, please shout. And we had branch 11. Okay, I'm going to just take the left part because it takes too long to write. And levels. Levels, if I have an empty binary tree, it's going to be, you know, empty levels, can't be anything else. If I have a branch with some root value and left and right subtrees, what do I get? you know, we looked at the picture. We put 12 as the first level. Well, easy. Let's write a so just extract the levels from left and right. That's how you make this automatically magically appearing solutions for the subproblems. And what we get? Root, and then we make some strange list. Yeah, it's almost like this. There's going to be a bug here. It's going to throw away stuff. But this is essentially what we want. So chip width, it you know takes two lists and you know chips them with the operator. So it's going to concatenate the respective elements on both sides of the list. So I have plenty of typos here. You know, if my slides are, you know, always messed up, not messing up this would be impossible. And yeah, this is requiring another argument. Okay. Yeah, small problem. I know that this would happen. What is happening? Chip width is, you know, not going through, if I have lists of different length, it's not really going to, you know, it's going to go through the shorter list and not the both of the lists. So I have to write another way of combining these. Let's call it, you know, if we have. Yeah, I don't have anything on the right. It has to be able to take that into account. And if I'm having nothing on the left, it's going to be. I'm not going to make this in the remaining 6 minutes until unless you help me. So okay, put enough hard time pressure and I can't explain and code at the same time. Did I get it correct? I think I did get it correct. If I didn't, I'll make a you know video where I code it again. So what I'm trying to convey here, that there is this magic thing that happens when you have a recursion as your tool. You have this insanely hard problem. For me, I'm no silly. I don't have lots capacity here. And then it magically turns the problem in something that is very simple. You have to you know, somehow divide your problem into two or more pieces. Yeah, binary tree, it's automatically done. There's left subtree and right subtree, and the node in the middle. Then you just make this recursive assumption. How many of you have done inductive proofs, proofs by induction in math? Yeah, that many. Excellent. This is the exact same step as the induction assumption. Is it called induction assumption? Yeah, that's the same thing. You assume that the you know, left subtree is solved. You assume the right subtree is solved. And then you just use these results to build up the whole answer, the answer to your big one problem. And this nothing difficult here anymore. The most difficult thing is that we have two lists and we have to concatenate all the elements, you know, piece by piece. That's the most difficult thing. Everyone can do that. Whereas, you know, I fully admit, when I was a student in the algorithms course, I never really managed to, you know, write this function. You know, they asked me to do it in C and not to use recursion, and I just failed. Have nightmares still. But with this thing, it's so very simple. Okay, so this is where we end with this lecture. Just ponder these things when you are walking home, especially the types. For the next lecture, we are going to, you know, toy with thing called quick check, study program properties, study how to do proofs by induction in Haskell, which is less horrible than it sounds. And we can catch up on other topics. And you have to tell me what are the topics that you want me to talk about, what you want to happen in the lectures. Just send me an email or send me a message in Slack. And quick check, that's one of my favorite things. I have to advertise first so everyone comes to the next lecture. Quick check is a simple testing technique. And there's lots of tools that work a bit like quick check. There's one that tests C code. And Antti Juhani wrote a Lisp interpreter in C. And Antti Juhani is, you know, the most precise programmer that I know. I mean, I don't know you, you might be as precise, but he's very precise. And this is a thing, I pull a lever, it takes me something like 30 minutes, or, you know, 3 minutes probably to set it up. And the tool takes 4 seconds to break Antti Juhani's program. You know, automatically shows that here are the bugs. Antti Juhani fixes the program. I pull the lever again. Now it takes, you know, 12 minutes. And one of the C libraries that Antti Juhani is using breaks. There is a bug in a readline library, apparently. Then Antti Juhani takes away the readline library. I pull the lever. And, you know, it doesn't break. I forget it running, come back after 3 hours, and there's something like Antti Juhani's program has crashed some like 8,000 times. It's not Antti Juhani's fault. The garbage collection library he used there seems to be broken. So this is a tool that you can just use to break everything. It's like a chainsaw and a rotten wood. If it's, you know, C code is the rotten wood. Okay, see you next time. Just check out these topics first.